Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to Center Point. I am your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will discuss ways that we can journey to our own centers. This can help us access our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. And today, I'm very happy to welcome back to our show Dr. Amir Raz, my good friend. Hello, Amir.
Hello, hello. How are you?
I am great. Dr. Raz is a neuroscientist, and he's written this outstanding book, The Suggestible Brain, which is now available online and in bookstores. And The Suggestible Brain is a compilation of Dr. Raz's thoughts about cognitive aspects of psychology, sociology, and anthropology with issues in our contemporary culture, media, and there's also a description of case studies in this book of patients with many kinds of disorders, including Tourette's syndrome, to false pregnancies, lactose intolerance, and asthma. And the book focuses on how suggestions can cut deep into our brains, shake our fundamental knowledge, and override our core human values. And in the promotional material for this book, Amir, you posed a number of questions I'd love to discuss with you. And so we're going to just dive right in. And the first question that you posed, which is, why do placebos work even when people know they are inactive? And maybe you can give us give us an example of how placebos work when people know they're inactive.
Right. So, in general, I think that there's a public conception of placebos as sugar pills or, you know, things that are akin to sugar pills. I mean, some people will construe them as pressed wood. Some people will construe them as water. Capsules, you know, whatever you want to call it, basically sweet nothing, something that does nothing or supposed to do nothing. And this conceptualization of placebos as things that are doing nothing is actually harmful to our understanding of how powerful these things are, because placebos are actually a very good example of how mental state, expectations, mindset, and so on, brain state, can actually change our physiology and influence our behaviors, influence our actions, and so on. Placebos have been known to medicine for a long time, and in modern medicine, we use them as some kind of a control group when we are doing clinical studies, when we're doing experimental studies in labs, and so on and so forth. The important thing is that only in recent time, I would say in the past 10 years or so, we have discovered that even when you give people inactive placebos, because there's also a form of active placebos that we can talk about a little bit later, but if we give people inactive placebos, in other words, pills or treatment or an intervention that really has nothing to recommend it chemically or biologically, people do get better. And this has been documented with migraines and headaches. This has been documented with lower back pain and with a slew of other things, you know, GI symptoms and so on. And then the question arises, how come when you give somebody a placebo in an open-label way, in other words, you say, here's a placebo, it doesn't have any active chemical ingredients that are likely to help you, but it's still going to help you, how does that work? And how does that manifest? What's happening in the brain? What's happening in the physiology of the person who's taking these things? And we are beginning to understand, slowly but surely, that our expectations, the way that we construe how the narrative that we have, the mindset that we have that actually surrounds the whole intake of whether it's a placebo or something else, actually plays a huge part in our response to it. So the ritual of taking something, even if it's a placebo, and even if we know that it's a placebo, actually has beneficial effect, or could have beneficial effect, on the outcome of taking even an open-label placebo.
So how does the ritual cause the necessary brain change, do we know?
Well, it's complicated, but it basically starts with the fact that expectation responses have a lot more to do than just the chemistry that is packed into a pill or into a drug. It has to do with ritual. It has to do with culture. It has to do with symbolism. It has to do with belief. It has to do with authority and succumbing to authority or complying with authority. It has to do with the price that we pay, how long we have to wait. It has to do with the chemical, I would say, rapport that we have, the chemistry that we have with our physician or with our clinician, the practitioner that we're interfacing with. It has to do with all kinds of what we call non-specific events or non-specific parameters that are sometimes as strong and sometimes stronger than the actual chemicals that are packed into the injection, into the pill, into the intervention that is being offered. And this is a world, the world of suggestion, the world of expectation, the world of influence through non-specific means, is a world that is just beginning. We're beginning to uncover and unveil the science that underlines it, and we're beginning to identify brain mechanisms and neural pathways and the functional neuroanatomy that plays into these top-down effects.
You know, Amir, as you describe the factors that play into the placebo response, it overlaps with religious stuff. Religions have rituals and authority figures and expectations. Is faith healing a kind of placebo?
Absolutely. I mean, when we are any kind of healing, including modern medicine, including the latest and greatest, medical interventions that we have, surgical interventions that we have, whether they're laser-based or gamma ray or, you know, whatever it is, super advanced technology, there is a placebo component to it. Sometimes it's very difficult to separate. Sometimes it's very difficult to tease apart how much of it is due to the actual intervention, to the actual procedure that we are performing, and how much of it is due to patient expectation, all kinds of side effects that the patient is experiencing, and so on and so forth. And when we do the experiments, and when we use very proper control groups, and this is not one experiment or two experiments, it's a series of long experiments longitudinally done over many, 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 many experiments, many years, and many patient groups, we are beginning to quantify and qualify placebo effect, who are good placebo responders, how does it work, how does it not work, and what the size effects are. And when we look at these things carefully and we're beginning to measure them and we're beginning to plot them, study them, you know, look at big data sets and so on, we're beginning to unravel a whole undercurrent, a whole force field that is completely dominated by our expectations, our, you know, the response that we have, including to things like faith, belief, and so on.
Have they done studies of a human giving a placebo? Let's say a human gives a pill and says, this is a placebo, but it'll help you, versus an artificial intelligence doing the same thing. And the reason I'm asking that question is that when a human does that, there's other factors, you know, interpersonal factors that play a role that maybe if a computer gave it to you, you won't get the same response. And yet the individual taking the pill might have expectations that could still allow the placebo to work. Has that study been done yet?
Well, I'm not familiar with a study like that exactly, but, you know, we're getting closer and closer to a time and certainly a technological, scene where we can begin to think about these studies and how to conduct them. The main issue with conducting placebo studies, believe it or not, is ethics. The research field or the research world is governed, and rightfully so, by ethic boards. and these are basically university-based or research-based committees that are looking into the research protocol that a researcher wants to conduct, and they determine whether the risk or whether the discomfort that the patient might experience is commensurate with the research value. And sometimes when we do these kind of experiments, the ethics board decides that this is not an ethical experiment to conduct because there's an element of deception or there's an element of misinforming the patient about what they're about to get or things like that. And that's where it becomes very, very difficult. And a lot of physicians, a lot of clinicians are shying away from using placebo, certainly officially or openly, because they're afraid of being delicensed or they're, you know, this is considered bad form. The most important thing here is that, you know, what we're beginning to do is we're beginning to uncover the actual science of how these things work, their clinical potential, and we're looking for ways to, you know, perform these things in a judicious and ethical way that would be helpful not just to the clinical community, but also, of course, to the patient community.
Can you give a specific example of a placebo experiment that somebody might consider unethical, just so we understand what the boards might have trouble with?
Yeah, so let's say that I'm interested, let's say that I have somebody who claims, or a bunch of people who claim that, you know, they're lactose intolerant, and I would like to see, you know, how much of their lactose intolerant is just something, some expectation or some form of thought that they have in their head, or something like that. So I might inform them, for example, that they're, you know, I'm going to give them a certain amount of milk, let's say, and I might tell them, hey, this milk is lactose-free, so you should have no problem drinking it. And actually, I might be misleading to them and giving them, you know, milk that has a little bit of lactose in order to see whether it's the expectation that it's going to be lactose-free and that it's safe to drink for them, or, you know, the fact that I'm contaminating it with a little bit of lactose, in order to see whether they're going to respond to it in, you know, through the biological channel, just because they're sensitive to the lactose and they're going to be, you know, their body is going to recognize it and give me some kind of a discomfort to the presence of lactose, or whether the fact that they think that it's lactose-free is going to override all that and, you know, make them, you know, basically go, the whole thing is going to go unnoticed. That would be one kind of experiment that is going to be ethically charged, for example. We can also do the reverse. We can tell people that we're giving them a lactose-containing milk at a very low dose when we're actually giving them lactose-free and tell them, well, let's see, you know, how much you can drink before you feel uncomfortable or something like that. This is the kind of thing that, you know, is very important to do every now and then, not because we're playing with the ethics, but we're, again, because we're trying to tease apart how much of a response is biologically driven, chemically driven, physiologically driven, how much of a response is actually driven by expectations, by ritual, by some kind of psychological belief that has to do with how the person's brain states are shaping the outcome.
But would an institutional review board reject that study because a patient might be exposed to lactose and have a bad allergic reaction?
Yeah, so, I mean, they could, and then it's the researcher's prerogative, it's the researcher's responsibility to articulate why the risks of the study, or why, you know, putting a patient in such a position would actually, you know, the benefits that we would glean, or the information that we would glean from such a study would outweigh the risks. If a researcher can convince an ethics board that this is warranted, the ethics board would approve such a study and the researcher can go ahead. This changes really from university to university, from medical school to medical school. It's a function of, you know, the risks that are involved. It's a function also of the ethical climate of the time. So, you know, decades ago, these studies were very easy to do. As a matter of fact, you know, I would argue that, you know, the atmosphere was too lax and researchers took advantage of it. Today, maybe the pendulum has swung all the way the other way. And today it's very difficult to do anything that would even reek of the smallest kind of deception, because people are extremely sensitive to things like autonomy, free will, and so on. So, I mean, it's difficult to say whether one position is right or the other one is right. One thing is for sure, what's ethical today is not ethical tomorrow. And, you know, these research protocols change with the times, and also they change with our technology and our understanding of the underlying science.
Can you get around that by telling the patients, hey, you might or might not be exposed to the real thing, or would that destroy the experiment in this particular example?
So it really depends on what you're trying to do. So the whole question of, for example, open-label placebos came about as an ethical way around it. So people were given placebos and were told openly and truthfully, genuinely, authentically, these are placebos, but they are likely to help you, and here's why. So they were given placebos in an open-label fashion, And they were given some kind of a narrative, some kind of an explanation by the researchers why those open-label placebos, why those chemically inert materials would still help them clinically. When that happened in a number of experiments by different researchers all over the world, and these studies, by the way, have been published in some of the best medical journals, again, peer-reviewed scientific medical journals in the field, these studies show unambiguously, in a very clear way, that we are dealing here with effects that are not just small statistically significant effects, but effects that are very large and clinically significant. And that's really the point.
Now, I would guess that telling the patient that this may help them is actually part of the reason it helps them. Would that be correct?
Yep. Some of it is what you tell the patient. Some of it is the support group that the patient has throughout the study. Some of it has to do with the fact that, let's say, the study is conducted, let's say, at Harvard University Medical School, and the imprint of the university, the fact that it's Harvard Medical School has some cachet associated with it. Some of it has to do with the fact that, maybe the patient is desperate because they've gone through a number of other experiments and they're desperate for something to work. Some of it might have to do with a particular kind of body warmth, quote-unquote body warmth, that the research staff exudes towards the patient in terms of the time that they spend, in terms of the follow-up, the phone calls, the appointments that they have. It's a very complicated business, and it's sort of a situation that requires a lot of attention to detail and a lot of attention to what constitutes clinical benefit. And this is something that a lot of people sometimes forget because they sort of confuse or they blur the difference between statistical significance, which is what a lot of scientists and a lot of clinicians use as sort of the criteria for what are the parameters that determine if something is effective, versus clinical significance, which is really what clinicians and practitioners in the field, in the trenches, need to base their decisions when they are trying to help patients who have specific problems.
When a child falls and scrapes her knee and the mother kisses her and she feels better, is that placebo in action?
That's placebo in action for sure, but there's also some physiology that we know about that is associated with that. So, for example, we know from, studies about pain and about somatosensory system and so on, that very light touch around flare-ups in the skin or hematomas or things like that activate a system of neural fibers that are, very helpful to healing and to activating the immune system and all that. These are insights that we, got through neuroscience and through neurobiology and neurophysiology many years after mothers and caretakers have used to, kiss the boo-boo of kids when they fell down and scrape their knee and so on. But the fact is that even though we know about these mechanisms today that we didn't know about before, there's clearly a very strong, extremely strong emotional response, support response, maternal or paternal response from the caretaker that plays a role, probably a very large role, in consoling, comforting, and healing the young child. And yes, these things can transfer to other domains in adults and other clinical situations.
And just to back up a second, a very basic question, why are clinical trials involving placebo? Why are things placebo-controlled?
We usually, when we ask a question, and the question could be as simple as, is this drug better than giving nothing? Like, let's say that we wait it out, or let's say that we give something that is not effective. How do we know that this drug is effective? How do we know that this intervention is effective? We need to compare it to something. Maybe people who take or receive this particular intervention would get better even if we give them no intervention. So we have to compare it to, for example, waitlisting them or just waiting. Let's say that, if we think that a particular drug is helpful for the flu, how about if we just let, give people a pill of pressed wood, as I said before, and see, if they're getting, if both groups get better after 2 weeks, then we know that, giving people a particular drug X, let's say, is really no different from, giving them a pressed wood pill. That would suggest that the treatment that we give is really not, that effective. If this sounds a little bit of mumbo jumbo, think about it, you know, a different way. Let's say that we are doing a study and we see that, I don't know, every time somebody smiles, we think that, you know, they live longer. So the more people smile, they live longer. So we sort of track all the people who smile with cameras and with whatnot. And then we see that, you know, when we look at a million people who smile versus a million people who don't smile so much, we see that the people who smile live longer. That's a very important kind of, you know, insight into, you know, into human life or into longevity. The question is, by how much? If the study shows that they live longer by 5 seconds, that's probably clinically insignificant. Because if you live longer by 5 seconds on a sample of a million people, that's not, but how about if it's 5 days? How about if it's 5 weeks, 5 years? At some point you say, hey, you know, that's already significant. 5 years is significant. If you can live 5 years longer because you're smiling more, maybe we should, you know, make people smile more. So the studies are not just about finding a difference between a particular intervention, a particular drug, and nothing, or a placebo, because placebos are not nothing. It's also about whether that difference is clinically significant.
Interesting. So can you give us, are certain kind of medical conditions more apt to improve with placebos?
Yes, certain conditions are definitely more apt to improve with placebos, and they would usually concentrate in particular fields of medicine. Some of them would be, for example, in psychiatry. Some of them are more concentrated in dermatology and pediatrics. And then we have, like, you know, certain specific things. Let's say in pulmonology, we know that, for example, asthma patients, that's certainly your field. You have the expertise, clinical expertise on these things. Asthma patients are not just responding biologically. They're also responding, you know, there's a stress element. There's an expectation element. So you can, you know, give people who are asthmatics, you can give them something that they would think would be an airway irritant, and you would, even if you give them just, you know, vapor, like water vapor, they would actually respond by showing some, you know, symptoms of shortness of breath, wheezing, and so on. This is very important to understand because it's part and parcel of the entire clinical picture.
Well, Amir, thank you for introducing us to the world of the suggestible brain. I have lots more questions. We'll be right back after these messages. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Coming attraction, Life Guide for Teens, Harnessing Your Inner Power to Be Healthy, Happy, and Confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Anbar to be published early 2025. Dr. Anbar's renowned counseling practice, CenterPoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Anbar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At CenterPoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at CenterPointMedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
More exhilarating talk. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. Our special guest, Dr. Amir Raz. We've been talking about the placebo effect as it reflects the a brain that's suggestible. So 25 years ago, as a practicing pulmonologist, mothers would come to sell me and ask me, well, my child is coughing. What over-the-counter medication can give for the cough? And I said, well, this has been extensively studied, and over-the-counter medications are no better than placebo, so there's nothing you can give, which is the wrong advice. Because, as you taught us in the last segment, the ritual of giving something is healing. And in fact, pediatricians kept prescribing over-the-counter medications because they did work. They improved kids' cough, but presumably because of the placebo effect. And so what I should have said in retrospect is give them some chicken soup, or if a child is older than a year, give them some honey, something, and then get a response. So is that an example of the placebo in action?
That would be definitely a variation on a placebo effect, sure. You have to understand, as you do perfectly well, that placebos come in many, many flavors and many variations and many situations. Placebos are context dependent. A placebo that works for somebody on Tuesday may not work on Thursday, and a placebo that works on a 12-year-old might not work on a 46-year-old. There's a lot of interesting factors that contribute our responses to placebos. It's not just things like education and genetic factors and so on. It's also, as I mentioned before, things that are related to religious belief and tendency towards spirituality, narratives, particular beliefs that people harbor, and so on. And an astute clinician, a seasoned practitioner, would know or would need to learn how to navigate the clinical armamentarium at their disposal to tailor the right intervention in a way that would benefit their patient as much as possible. And sometimes this calls for, in addition to medications that are known to be effective through their chemical ingredients or through their, well-established research, evidence-based science, also through an element that we call non-specific factors that would sometimes entail enhancing the placebo effect. And that needs to happen through interaction with the patient, through setting particular expectations, and then you have to play a very, very delicate game of doing it judiciously and ethically.
Now, I think this overlaps with something you discussed in your book. Why do red pills cause stress and blue pills feel calm? How does that work?
Well, I mean, I think that most people understand intuitively that the color red, in our culture, certainly is associated with things like blood and stop signs and alert and things that indicate danger and stop and so on. Whereas blue things are associated with things like, the blue sky or the blueness of the water or the vast expanses of some kind of a vacation world, things that are slightly more relaxing. When you are using red pills, you're automatically pressing some kind of a, if you want to call it a subconscious button, although I don't like to use these kind of Freudian terms, but you're using some kind of an indirect suggestion that, there's some kind of stimulation going on, because red puts you on alert. It puts you on, some kind of a heightened vigilance mode. It has to do with danger. It has to do with stop, like I said before. Whereas blue is probably something that has more of a chamomile effect, something that is more relaxing, something that gives you a tiny bit more of a pause. Studies have shown that these things are not just minor effects. Sometimes they can be major, depending on the context and what people expect. Forgive me. So, for example, to give sleeping pills that are red is a little bit of a sort of a medical oxymoron. And I think that pharmacy or pharmacological companies, drug companies, have internalized that a long time ago.
It's very interesting. In the movie The Matrix, people are offered the red pill, which would wake them up to find out what reality was, and then, or the blue pill, stay in their calm state. Same thing.
Yeah. So people have done, even outside of medicine, people have done studies where they look at performance, cognitive performance of individuals who are in the red rooms or in the blue rooms. Excuse me, I'm like choking here. I'm not sure why. Maybe I took like a placebo pill for that I think is interfering with my voice here. Sometimes people who are in blue rooms or in red rooms demonstrate that their cognitive performance is very different when it comes to solving problems and so on. Some of these studies are viable. In other words, it actually shows that these effects are there, and some of the studies show that they were designed in a way that was a little bit flawed. So it's very difficult to conclude that these are real big effects. It's very clear that they are there, the effects are there, but they're usually on the smaller side. However, when it comes to medical interventions, we can see that these little things, including little comments from the clinician, a smile, a reassuring comment, for example, as opposed to a snarky comment or an ambiguous statement that might be interpreted in a negative way, these things sometimes can have a much bigger effect on clinical outcome than anything that we sometimes consider that has to do with the potency of the intervention itself.
Yes, and it makes, which was part of the art of medicine that we are starting to learn quite how it works, but you know, we talk about evidence-based medicine. Typically, that's what's out there, what's been studied, drugs have been studied, but they don't look at all these effects. I don't know if drug studies looking at how the clinician prescribes the medication, what kind of difference it does, but it can make a big difference, as you describe.
Absolutely, and in general, in medicine, we have, people who go to medical school, even people who go and do a residency and become medical professionals, there is a field in medicine that is called, or you know, sort of loosely goes under the caption or the label of bedside manners. And under this kind of label, bedside manners, everything goes. Like all the nonspecific effects go, you know, from smiling to waiting rooms to your interaction with the patient and how you communicate and all these things. But we are talking about much more than bedside manners. We're talking really about a way that you can shape the influence of suggestion on physiology and on how to harness placebo effects or expectation effects, or if you want to call it suggestion effects, on changing the physiology. And this is a whole field that science is making very interesting connections to all the time. I mean, it's a field that is growing. I wouldn't say exponentially because it's a small field and it's led by a relatively small community, but the contributions there are very, very significant.
Well, fascinating stuff. We've spent most of the show so far talking about how suggestion affects placebo and the medical effects of placebo. When we come back from the break, I want to shift gears and I want to talk about suggestions and politics, which I think is a good thing to talk about in this post-election period.
Sure.
This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Unbar.
Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. With the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit dranbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Coming attraction, life guide for teens harnessing your inner power to be healthy, happy, and confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Ambar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Ambar. Special guest, Dr. Amir Raz, who is sharing his vast knowledge regarding suggestions. He's the author of The Suggestible Brain that's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other booksellers. I commend it highly. So let's talk. We want to shift gears. One of the questions you look at in your book is, why are we more likely to believe fake news that already aligns with our political beliefs?
Yeah. So, you know, in order to answer something like that, you know, why we're likely to, believe or follow or subscribe to fake news more than we do to other things, we have to take one or two steps back and sort of talk a little bit about, you know, what suggestion is really and how people construe it, because I think that's very important to understanding how these things come about. And when it comes to suggestion and suggestions to humans in general, I think most people lack a definition. Because definitions are helpful, but sometimes, of course, they can also make things more complicated. So, for example, if we are thinking about, I don't know, art or love or consciousness, different cultures, time periods, scientific paradigms may offer drastically different views on these terms, yet all of us understand what they are. When people are given a suggestion for something, they pay more attention to suggestions that are sort of in line or overlap greatly with their belief system. When something overlaps, even partially, with your belief system, you pay more attention to it because it has some elements there that resonate with you. And if I can give you a suggestion that on the one hand has some overlap with your worldview and on the other hand can have like some kind of a sensational element to it, it can introduce you to a new secret kind of dimension, or it can, you know, I can expose all kinds of things that are known to very few, or something that, you know, when you know about it, you suddenly realize how two points are connected, even if they're not connected. Many people find that attractive. It's sort of a human trait. They find it attractive. So it's not just a question of misinformation, because I can give you misinformation that would be very uninteresting for you. I can give you, you know, misinformation that would be super boring. But if I can give you misinformation that would allow you to connect two points or three points or two concepts in a way that overlaps with your thinking, with your knowledge base, and in a way that creates some kind of a connection between these points, even if they're not connected, many people will find it attractive because it helps them to come out with another narrative or a theory that explains the chaotic world around them in a slightly better way. So people who are, you know, feeding or fueling the misinformation fire need to do it also in a way that so misinformation is attractive, but it becomes all the more so when you can sort of anticipate what kind of knowledge base you're dealing with and how you can connect points that for most people are disconnected.
Are you describing how conspiracy theories spread?
For example, this would work very well with conspiracy theories for sure, but it would also work with many other things that are not necessarily conspiratorial in nature. You know, even explanations as to, you know, why certain things happen in a certain way. So the confusion or the thing of correlation with causation, for example. So people have a tendency to blur correlation and causation anyway, because causality is very difficult for us to understand. Our brains are, you know, pattern seekers, and we sort of recognize patterns even when they're not there. And if I give you information that would allow you to recognize patterns and then connect them and give you false causation between things, this is something that the human brain naturally tends to do anyway. So by, you know, feeding you with information that would allow you to do this even more naturally, I'm setting up, you know, honey traps for you that you would just, you know, get into quickly and inexorably.
Yeah, and so I'm thinking about things I'm aware of. So I think about people thinking that immunization is called autism because around the time that people are given immunizations, autism tends to develop, and people have made that connection, which we cannot prove scientifically that people believe it. Or I was thinking, again, this is from my world, people believe, some anti-Semitic people think Jews are responsible for certain things because they occurred around the time the Jews were there, but there's not a direct connection.
These are very good examples because they've also been studied thoroughly, and people have looked at, you know, pretty large data sets. Now, in the case of, for example, autism and vaccinations, or vaccinations and autism, this has been further fueled, of course, by a particular study that actually claimed for such a connection by a very incompetent clinician who was able to sort of set this on fire. You know, unfortunately, this was published at a reasonably good medical journal that since, you know, the article was published, it was also retracted, but nobody pays attention to retraction. Nobody pays attention to the aftermath and how people studied it and actually demonstrated, you know, fairly and clearly that there's no relationship between vaccinations and autism. And, you know, go and try to undo something, you know, like that. It's a very, very difficult uphill battle. So when the information is moving from the peer-reviewed journal to the social media platforms, it's a lost cause because people then speak out of their ears and they say whatever they want to say and they give examples and other people listen to those examples and they sort of confuse science and, you know, science-based or evidence-based paradigms with anecdotes and with what people say. And it's very difficult for somebody who's a layperson, somebody who's not conversant with the scientific method or with the scientific paradigm to sift through this kind of information and make a reasonable judgment. People are just not versed in this kind of critical thinking, and as a result, we live in a world where a lot of these things, whether it's about anti-Semitism and how the Jews control the world, or if it's about vaccinations and how they cause autism, or how vaccinations cause infertility, or anything like that, it's very easy to generate these kind of rumors, all kinds of spineless information that runs, and spreads like wildfires, and then it's very difficult to undo.
So I think we're all prone to this kind of suggestibility. So if you tell me something that kind of makes sense to me and add something interesting, I might believe you, but how is one to guard against it? I don't want to get misinformation. How do I protect myself?
Well, the first thing that people need to understand is that to be suggestible or to be, you know, influenced by suggestion is not necessarily a bad thing. It's a learning mechanism. Suggestion is a form of communication that brings about a belief or thought without explicit imposition or command, even without awareness sometimes. Perhaps, making it impossible for the person to oppose or feel the need to do so. So it's many ways, suggestion is a very important tool that humans have to navigate our changing world and in a very chaotic environment. On the other hand, everybody is suggestible to some things. If you realize how suggestible you are, if you realize that you are likely more suggestible in certain domains, the first thing that you need to understand is what domains you're more likely to be suggestible in, and then you can take some measure to counteract and to do a little bit more research or to be a little bit more mindful before you accept information. But the first thing is to understand that everybody, to some extent, is suggestible.
A lot to think about. We'll be right back. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com. Or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At CenterPoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. My special guest, Professor Amir Raz, author of The Suggestible Brain, available on Amazon and other booksellers. So we're talking about if you're suggestible, you might need to be more careful. Is there like a test you can take to find out how suggestible you are?
Absolutely. So suggestibility comes in many flavors. It's not one thing. But we have certain kinds of suggestibility that have been really studied quite well with very good supporting data about its test-retest reliability. For example, in the context of hypnosis, hypnotic suggestion, which is a particular kind of suggestion, is something that has been studied very well since the late 50s, early 60s, until today. And we do have certain structured interviews that allow us to check. Not always very quickly. Sometimes it takes an hour, sometimes it takes more, depending on how rigorous the test is and how technically detailed it is. But we can determine with pretty good scientific accuracy who is likely to be suggestible when it comes, for example, to hypnotic suggestion. In similar ways, We have things that are called imaginative suggestibility and other forms of suggestibility. I don't want to get into it too much. It becomes very technical and very there are all kinds of semantic differences that are not important to this conversation here. But the form of suggestibility that people have and our ability to identify it can be extremely helpful in offering them not just psychological therapy, but also clinical interventions that have to do with changing their physiology. And this is something that a lot of people this concept is relatively new to a lot of people, including clinicians, not just patients.
So let's say somebody takes one of these suggestibility hypnosis tests and find out they're suggestible. Is this person more likely to respond to the placebo effect? Is this person going to be more likely to respond to fake news?
Not necessarily. They're not necessarily. It doesn't necessarily translate into feeble-mindedness or spinelessness or, you know, being a person who cannot think for themselves. It just means that under in a particular context, let's call it a hypnotic context, that has to do with a form of induction or a form of relaxation or a form of interaction with a hypnotic operator, they can respond more than other people who are less suggestible to hypnotic suggestion to a particular suggestion, a particular narrative. And if we talk about, you know, in that context, it might be important to say, you know, what a suggestion is. And then I would say that a suggestion in that context would be some kind of an uncritical acceptance of an opinion or an idea or a behavior, which arises either from within us or from the influence of this hypnotic operator. So some people are more likely to accept a particular idea, a particular narrative in those particular situations. That's very important. Of course, you can use it. You can use it in a negative fashion. I mean, you can go and suggest to somebody all kinds of negative things or horrible things. We don't want to go there. That's very unethical and something that, you know, is considered bad form any day. But we can also do a lot of good things with that. We can help people tremendously deal with all kinds of hang-ups and issues that that they harbor. The more important thing in this field of being suggestible and so on is the idea that suggestibility really is a gift. It's almost like, you know, a form of attention. It's the fact that people can, in certain situations, take information and internalize it and process it in a way that changes the physiology. And if we can harness it for the better, we can really help them.
But am I hearing you correctly that suggestibility in the hypnotic world does not necessarily mean you'll be suggestible in the political world or with the placebo in the medical
world? So there is, it's an interesting question, and we know that there are some overlaps between everyday suggestibility and hypnotic suggestibility. We know that hypnotic suggestibility is actually predictive in terms of other forms of suggestibility, but it does not, there's no causal relationship that we've been able to establish that somebody who's hypnotically suggestible automatically means that they are good placebo responders. That does not occur. We haven't been able to establish that kind of a relationship, but we have been able to establish that people who are highly suggestible in a hypnotic domain are sometimes also very suggestible in other domains and in other specific contexts. We're still trying to study these things in a way that would be that would allow us to operationalize them into clinical situations, and how to do this responsibly, and how to take into account things like genetic factors or psychological profiles of people, for example, their attentional profiles or their ability, temperament profiles or personality. But this is work that has been relatively new, and most of the studies that have come out have been relatively preliminary. So we cannot conclude anything yet, but it's very promising, and we're beginning to see some very interesting correlations.
Can you touch briefly on the concept of self-suggestion? What can I do for myself?
You know, any kind of suggestion, it doesn't matter if it comes from other people and it comes from a hypnotist or a physician or a spouse or an investment expert or anybody, your neighbor, any kind of suggestion at the end of the day is an auto-suggestion, because you have to take it in and then you have to sort of repeat it to yourself. You have to, you know, work on it with yourself. Everyone is highly susceptible to some form of suggestion, often without realizing it. And these suggestions shape our perceptions, our behaviors, even our physiological experience in profound ways. any kind of suggestion at the end of the day is self-suggestion, because you have to take it from the source and you have to somehow repackage it for yourself, and you have to sort of re-narrate it to yourself. So subtle cues, expectations, beliefs can dramatically influence our decisions, our physical sensations, even our emotional states, whether in everyday life or in clinical settings. At the end of the day, any person who says, oh, this is a suggestion that I got from my neighbor, I got this from my lover, this is not good enough, because at the end of the day, the suggestion becomes a self-suggestion that you take and you run with yourself.
And how do you decide what suggestion to take in? Do you think about it consciously? Because you're also taking a lot of things on the subconscious, or, you know, without being
aware. That's right. And this is where it gets really interesting and complicated, because some suggestions operate on us in a way that we're even, you know, unaware. And this is where we really need to understand a little bit better what's the difference between suggestions that are, you know, we accept and we are aware of, and what kind of suggestions we are sort of accepting, and maybe we become aware of it later. We're not aware of it at the time. Maybe we never become aware of it. These are very subtle experiments that we're just beginning to do. They're very complicated experiments, but it's very clear that there is an element of suggestion that is outside of our awareness versus suggestions there are. The key takeaway is that suggestion is not just a tool for, you know, in my book I talk about magicians and hypnotists. Aspect of it really is a fundamental aspect of human neuropsychology that operates in all areas of life. And understanding how suggestion works allows us to harness its power to improve well-being, resist manipulation like we talked about before, and better navigate our personal reality. Ultimately, suggestibility, but whether it's hypnotic suggestibility or otherwise, is not a sign of weakness, but a complex, deeply rooted aspect of the human mind that we can leverage to our advantage, from mental health and performance sports all the way to self-regulation and resilience training. And that's really the point. Our mindset and the functionality of our brain states is as trainable and pliable as aspects of our anatomy and physical characteristics.
Wow. Amir, thank you so much for what you taught us. Thank you for writing the book, The Suggestible Brain, and I look forward to learning more from you in the future. Thank you for appearing
with us. Thank you so much, Ron.
This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anvar.